Earwolf, more like Fearwolf. Get ready to quake in your headphones or your headphones boots, because Earwolf podcasts are getting extra spooky this October. Listen to How Did This Get Made, The Canon, and us, your friends at Crack Movie Club, dissect spine-tinkling horror classics all month long. And watch out for special spooktacular episodes of Gilbert Gottfried's amazing Boo-lossal podcast, The Cracked Podcast, and Who Charted, or should I say Boo-charted. Stick with us at Crack Movie Club. We're doing John Carpenter month all October long. We're going to be getting into some of his chilling horror classics like The Thing and Halloween. It's going to be a lot of fun, so you guys should definitely listen to it. Also, the Crack Podcast is doing an episode about weird folk monsters that deserve their own movies, so you should check that out. Follow along on social media with hashtag Fearwolf so you don't miss out on any Halloween action. Hey everyone, welcome to the Crack Movie Club, the show where we try to make you an expert on your favorite films. I'm one of your hosts, Tom Ryman. Abe is out for this week. In his place, we have guest host Bridget Greenberg.
It's me!
That's you. And we're the self-appointed crack movie experts. We're here to point out some things you may or may not know about your favorite classics and drop observations that might ruin the movie, or maybe not, depending on how mature you are, how willing you are to take chances. It's up to you, really. Today, we're continuing our month on John Carpenter with 1988's They Live. Along with us is our guest, Matt McCarthy, who is a very funny comedian, host of the We Watch Wrestling podcast. He's also been on At Midnight and Conan.
The boss is back, man! That's a Roddy Piper line.
Oh, man. He's wearing... You guys... There's a visual component to this podcast you guys can't see, but Matt is wearing a Hot Rod t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Just the best, as this movie stars Roddy Piper.
That's right. If you ordered the special edition of the Roddy Piper Born to Controversy DVD, it came with the free t-shirt.
Okay, before we begin, when was the first time you saw They Live?
Wow. I couldn't say. I mean, definitely whenever it was on video, and probably, you know, very soon after it was first released on video and you can rent it. Did not see it in the theater. So maybe 1989 or 1990, one or the other.
The theater of the mind.
The theater of the mind, either in my basement or in Kevin McNamara's living room. This was a big one. We were very excited.
Yeah, it was because of the presence of Roddy Piper.
Sure. Well, he left WWF after WrestleMania 3 to go make movies.
Yeah.
Gonna give it a shot, man. Gotta go. You know.
Yeah. I guess we'll get into this in the episode, but apparently that was part of like a negotiation tactic almost on his part.
He went and made They Live and he made Hell Comes to Frogtown. And
it's another fabulous movie.
That movie is off the charts, bonkers.
Oh, that movie is the next level. Everybody should watch that. They've done an episode of How Did This Get Made on it, but you have to experience Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Yeah, it's a good 45, 47 minutes before the first frog person even shows up. But it's so worth it. I love Roddy Piper movies.
Could you give us a brief synopsis of They Live, like one or two sentences?
A drifter stumbles upon a like a commune and then finds a box of sunglasses which allow one to see the world as it truly is, and reveals a sinister plot by... It's never made quite clear, like, they're aliens, but it's also, are they dead? Are they dead aliens? Because it's They Live, and they also look like corpses.
That's true.
It's very interesting, but at any rate, that they are controlling us, and it's the game is rigged, the table is tilted, and they are controlling us through subliminal messages, and that we're basically livestock, and so then he has to spearhead a revolution to overthrow our, well, for lack of a better word, our evil reptile overlords.
Yeah. The revolution is him and another guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ironically, the revolution is not televised.
No, that's true. That's a pretty good sum up.
It's excellent.
Yeah. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary, reductive summaries. Feel free to join us in our segment, Terrible Log Lines.
New friends bond over having the same kind of sunglasses.
In an unexpected turn of events, a good guy with a gun rampages against the 1%.
Transient construction worker goes on a killing spree after the television tells him everyone is aliens.
A homeless person takes a tour of a TV station.
A down-on-his-luck construction worker becomes extremely violent after running out of bubblegum.
Two heroes storm the CNN building to put an end to fake news.
A famous pro wrestler and a famous voiceover artist get into a very long fight.
They sure do.
Rowdy Roddy Piper asks zero questions and joins a cult after trying on a pair of sunglasses.
A man shoots a woman to death for not being grateful he abducted her.
Wow. What's her name? The woman who hits him in the head with the bottle?
Holly.
No, the actress.
Meg Howard?
Meg Foster.
Yeah.
Now that you know the plot of the movie, let's dive into the making of the movie from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending. So this movie, like a lot of John Carpenter's movies, is very anti-government. So many of his films are just about how much he does not like authority and how much he distrusts the government. Like last week's episode, we were talking about Escape from New York, which is very much a post-Watergate film.
Call me Snake.
Yeah. So this movie came out at the end of the 80s. It came out actually in 88 after the election. So the Reagan 80s were kind of over, but this movie's very much about the Reagan 80s and Reaganomics and the wealth disparity and all that stuff. And it was also at the end of a decade that had been particularly unkind to John Carpenter. He had a lot of studio movies that came out this decade that underperformed, like The Thing, which we're going to talk about next week, is now like a big like cult movie, as is They mm-hmm. Live, as is pretty much all of his movies. Yeah. But
when you start next week's episode, will you make me a promise now that you'll start it by saying, here's the thing.
I will 100% do that. Yeah. That is going to happen.
It's up to you, the listeners, to keep him to his word.
Yeah, can hold me to it. So this movie, in a lot of ways, you know, because it's about frustration of the sort of working and underclass toward, you know, the ruling upper class and mm-hmm. wealthy. It's also, in many ways, an extension of Carpenter's frustration with working in the studio system and making movies that are, you know, objectively good because they've stood the test of time, but just didn't perform at the box office when they came out.
It's not about that, man. It's about the art, man.
Exactly, yeah.
Did Ingmar Bergman ever make money, man?
I legitimately don't know.
He must have been a draw.
He must have made some money. Yeah. Like, he kept cranking them out. So, yeah, he wrote the script to this film, Carpenter did, under the pseudonym Frank Armitage, which is a reference to Professor Armitage from the Dunwich Horror, which is a Lovecraft story, and Carpenter's super into Lovecraft.
Rhode Island native, just like me.
Lovecraft, yeah, definitely, yeah. And his movie, In the Mouth of Madness, is very much a Lovecraft movie.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a good ask. We're not going to be covering it this month, but because we only have...
With what's his name from Ghostbusters 2, isn't it?
Viggo, yeah.
He wrote me too. I saw that in the theater.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine seeing that movie in the theater.
At like, you know, like the dirt theater for like a dollar. Oh, like, man. You know, in the fifth week of release or whatever.
That's like the only way I imagine that movie plays.
Yeah. Well, then it's creepy because then it's like he basically at the end of the movie winds up in the theater we're
right,
in.
Yeah. In a theater, yeah. Yeah. By himself.
Right.
Watching the events of his life.
Right.
Ah, that's such a mindfuck of a movie. So anyway, this film is based on a short story called 8 O'Clock in the Morning by Ray Nelson, which is about aliens hypnotizing people. And John Carpenter saw a graphic novel adaptation of it in a comic anthology series called Alien Encounters in the mid-80s. So he based the basic idea of aliens having hypnotized the entire human race to keep them pacified.
Yeah.
He took that basic idea. Otherwise, his They Live and the story are very, very different, but
right.
He took that basic idea and used that to write this script. And interestingly, I was reading that apparently science fiction is like his favorite genre, even though he's more known as a horror director.
I believe that. Well, so subversive.
Yeah.
You can, like the subtext in such a majority of science fiction is very much that. It's just like there's... Like you think of like all those Rod Serling Twilight Zones that are like
100%.
Oh, I see what you. I get what you meant.
Yeah,
you meant another thing.
You adorable man.
Or even Star Trek. Like I remember when one of the actors said to Rod Serling to Gene Roddenberry very early on, like, "Wait, you're doing morality plays?" And he's like, "Shh." The network hasn't figured it out.
Yeah, Star Trek is very much Twilight Zone in space.
Yeah,
it's these societal. Pieces of societal commentary just dressed up in in science fiction, and that's a lot of Carpenter's movies.
Yeah. And that's also what horror is. So whenever you bend sci-fi and horror, it's going to become a morality thing. But also, yeah, it's clear that Carpenter's a big fan of sci-fi. Just a fan, because this, he doesn't quite pull it off.
You don't think so?
I don't think he quite pulls it, because the science behind all this is just like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the conspiracy that they're running makes no sense here.
Well, we'll get there, but by the time
they get to the spaceship, you're like, oh, so we're going to find the plan, and...
No.
No, they just shoot people.
No, their plan is just, yeah, money.
He shoots his way out of it.
You know what's really interesting is if James Cameron had directed this movie, he would have pretended he never saw that comic book and given them no credit.
Yeah, 100%.
That's his little game.
Yeah. He worked on Escape from New York.
I bet he did. I bet he did everything he could to bring that movie down from the inside.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Harlan Ellison has his own thing with, like, I forget what story it is that he stole to do Terminator.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's a snake.
Yeah, he is.
Call him snake.
I saw a comment with Carpenter where he always feels like aliens in movies should be evil. And he specifically called E.T. and Close Encounters not valid, which is weird because he made Starman. And Starman is like a good alien.
What does he mean, not valid? Like,
I don't know. It's just what he said. And I just thought that was incredible. So I wrote
I know aliens. So they're not.
They're not valid.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I was going to take it out of alien canon.
Right. Which is weird because, like I said, he made Starman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, like, famously one of the nicest aliens, even though he comes.
Yeah. Again, back to Ghostbusters 2. He gets mentioned at the beginning.
Starman.
Like, it's not going to be a nice one. Like, Starman. Usually it's some giant lizard.
The script is specifically anti-Reagan. His comments about it were that Reagan was a rich man telling us don't get in the way of the rich because if they make more money, you'll get some. Which is kind of what happens in the movie, you know, like they end up seducing humans into their plot by being like, hey, we'll make you rich too. And so Carpenter meant for the aliens specifically to represent the Republican Party. And like in a couple of behind the scenes stuff, he calls the aliens Republicans.
Oh, I love that.
So... It was specifically about the wealth disparity and then the fact that Reagan was destroying unions and poverty increased. So he wanted to, I think it's surprisingly effective in the first act of the movie, but he wanted to show the working homeless because Carpenter felt that most Americans don't think exist or don't realize exist. And they're never really shown in movies too often. So he thought it was important, particularly in the Reagan 80s, to make a movie about this and also have the two heroes be working homeless. And they're both from, like, Frank talks about how he's from Detroit. And, you know, Detroit famously was crushed by all this nonsense and that he had to move out to find work after, you know, the steel mill he was working for shut down. And then they got a bailout. And Derek's like, oh, they got a bailout. And then what'd they do for us? Like, we got fired and they got raises. So, like, that was Carpenter's, like, real libertarian view on the...
Right, yeah, it's not a hidden theme at all.
He makes it very, very clear. Yeah, it's very explicit. I do know that the soundtrack was improvised. Like a lot of Carpenter's movies, he just kind of watches it and, like, you know, just kind of plays, and then they edit it together later.
He definitely sits there for 2 minutes and then goes, good enough, just the whole movie. Well, my wife was in the next room. I'm watching the movie. And then she comes running and she goes, what the hell are you watching? Turn it off. It's making me crazy. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, it's just that bass line.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't, and I didn't notice it until she said it. It's the whole
You can't
whole
unhear it.
No. That's all you can hear, the whole movie.
There are only two themes. There's the alien theme, which is kind of like a march. Like it's, and then there's the blues theme, and it's those two themes.
Doom, doom, doom.
Yep.
Right. Well, that one you hear so much because the first half of the movie, or the first act of the movie at least, is so quiet that that's all you hear. Like
a lot of walking around.
It's a lot of walking. Yeah, like a lot of long shots of Roddy Piper just
very
walking.
Very understated, almost soulful performance from Roddy Piper
until
in the first
he starts
minutes.
Talking. And then he immediately
loses his
0 to 60.
Mind.
Yeah.
Well, he gets rowdy.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah. Ask no questions and immediately is like, okay, we're into aliens. I'm on board. I get it. I'll start killing.
Well, he says it himself. He's like, I figured it would have been something like this.
Yeah,
it figures.
He had it in him.
Yeah, he's like, of course.
He had it in him all along. He had a crazy
conspiracy.
Honestly,
if I put on those sunglasses, if this movie had never existed, right. If I put on the sunglasses, I'd be like, uh-huh. Yep.
Of course. Time for me to shoot up a bank.
Yeah, you're just going like, I'm going to the bank.
Yep. Time to make a withdrawal. Time to deposit some bullets.
But a little bit about the financing of this film. John Carpenter actually had control of Final Cut of this film, which is very rare for a director. But he struck that deal with Alive Films. As long as he stayed within budget of around $3 to $4 million, which is very, very cheap for a sci-fi movie.
Movie that films in downtown Los Angeles.
And sci-fi action movie.
Yeah.
With that many extras who... We'll get into this later. All mostly played by one man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, we can keep talking about that. Yeah, I just want to say that Alive Films also produced Prince of Darkness with Carpenter, the two Wes Craven movies, Shocker and People Under the Stairs, and they also produced Cool as Ice, the Vanilla Ice movie.
So they...
Delightful.
Yeah.
Cast Roddy Piper after he saw him in WrestleMania 3.
I mean, who
really?
Wouldn't?
Was it that late?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah. He was apparently either Carpenter's agent or Piper's agent brought... Roddy to Carpenter's box, wherever he was watching. His Carpenter's a longtime wrestling fan, and just met with him. And after talking to him for a little bit, he was like, "Yeah, I can put this guy. Wow. I can put
also
put this
in
guy
Michigan,
in the movie." Really?
The Pontiac Silverdome.
Yep. Oh wow!
Yeah, because Carpenter didn't want to overuse Kurt Russell, which is a ridiculous thing to say.
Right? You never. I don't think that's possible.
Right.
But it was a wise decision.
It turned out for the best.
Overuse your muse.
Right. But right. It turned out for the best.
Yeah, I can
Roddy Piper's.
Oh, he's amazing.
Perfect.
I can picture this movie with Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. But like so much of What They Live is
right.
Roddy Piper.
It wouldn't
like,
be yeah, it wouldn't be no. This cult classic
no,
if Roddy
no, no,
Piper
no, no, no.
wasn't just ad-libbing his thrown out wrestling lines.
Yeah, I think he actually used the bubblegum line. In a promo.
Yeah, because I know a lot of his...
But a lot of his lines came from his own notebook where he just wrote down things trash
that
he would talk.
Yeah. Yeah. So anything that he didn't use in WrestleMania made it into this movie, which...
One of the things that Carpenter liked about him was that he had the... Because, you know, Piper's not an ugly man, but he has, like, he's got scars and he looks like
he's a rugged.
Yeah, he looks rugged. He looks like a working guy. You know, yeah. Like he looks like a regular dude. And also, Piper had apparently, according to the commentary, Piper had lived on the streets before.
Yep. Yeah. Kid on the streets started. The way he tells the story, he said a priest. He was like, he started pro wrestling when he was, you know, like 14.
Mm-hmm.
And a priest talked to him and he's like, because he started out boxing.
Oh, okay.
And then transition into the world of wrestling at a time where the business was so protected, it was like, you know, you didn't find out it was a work until you'd maybe already been in it for like a year or something. Because they would just beat the shit out of you to protect the business, to keep out. So at any rate, he said a priest pulled him aside and he said, Roddy, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be out on the street. You're going to be hungry. You're going to break into somebody's house. They're going to arrest you. Then they're going to beat you. They're going to rape you. And they're going to kill you.
Damn.
And he's like, you know this for sure, Father? And he's like, but I got something better for you. And then he trained him to be a boxer. And it went from there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he was talking about in the scene where the police raid the shanty town. He was talking about how that scene was... hard for him, like it's affecting him in the commentary for the film. He wouldn't get specifically into it, but he said, yeah, this is like me. I'm like, I'm drawing on a legitimate memory here. Like, this is
I believe
difficult.
He's acting in that scene.
He is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still in the subdued portion of the film where he's like, I think like the first 30 minutes of this film in rewatching it for this podcast, I was like legit impressed with his performance in the first act of the movie. I'm like, he's very subtle and understated.
He's a sensitive soul. Like,
yeah.
I met him on a couple of occasions, and then from what everyone else always said about him, like, he was, like, legitimate, genuine. Like, he's the type of guy, like, he would hug you as a stranger. He'd just be like, oh, thank you so much.
I have a buddy of mine back in Virginia books kind of a local wrestling promotion, and they brought in Piper a few years ago. And my brother got to meet with Piper a little bit and said he was just like the nicest guy. Like, Piper gave him a bottle of scotch because he wasn't drinking at that point. a fan had given it to him, and wow. he was like, "Are you a scotch drinking man?" to my brother, and gives him this $100 bottle of scotch.
That's so wow. nice.
Yeah. So yeah. he was just apparently, and my friend who booked the show, she's like, "Yeah, he was one of the nicest guys we've ever booked."
That's good to hear. But also in that scene where they're raiding the town, I had to stop and like rewatch the scene so many times and rewatching because he's getting a kid out of the way while the police are like beating the hell
out of the blind guy. Yeah,
but yeah, he takes his kid and they find the house and he throws this kid through the window to protect him. But then he climbs through the window and there's a chair maybe like 3 feet to his left and he's climbing through the window and just punches his chair away. And I watched it. I was like, did he have to do that? And I rewound like 3 times. And I was like, no, that chair was nowhere near him. Yeah, he just destroyed that chair because he's like, this will look cool. And like,
not in his way at all. Yeah. He just like slaps it out of the way. Like he sees it and is like, no. And then climbs through the window. And I was watching on the commentary track, Carpenter goes like, he points that out.
Yeah,
It was after you told me about it, so I was watching for it again. And like he points out, I really like what you did there. Like, he slaps the stool the hell out of the way.
It was so confusing to me.
But so nobody can follow him in through the window.
It's a distraction. And
look what he did to that chair.
Yeah. We can't go in there.
We can't go in there.
It's far too dangerous.
He ain't got a full deck.
We mentioned Meg Foster earlier. Carpenter cast her after seeing her in a movie called Ticket to Heaven, where she played a cult leader. So some of that is in this movie. Because you're supposed to, at least I'm assuming, that she's with the aliens the entire time.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't...
She's a spy.
Yeah, or like, I mean, she's just... Or she's like one of the humans. In their fold.
Right, yeah. I think she's just, yeah.
Yeah. So she leads them to their little resistance bunker.
Right.
They shoot everybody.
Yeah, she's a... She's creepy. I don't think her character's that well thought out, but she does a good job in, like, can't read her.
No.
I don't think she blinks once in this movie.
Oh. No.
She's stone cold. Just
She's
not giving anybody anything.
No, and man.
And the most calm kidnapping victim I've ever seen.
She just rolls with it.
Cool.
Yeah. And which is what makes when she does the 360 backhand bottle smash.
Then
he flies out the window.
Yeah.
Oh, man. John Carpenter has said repeatedly that he doesn't understand why people think this movie is funny. Specifically, like, the fight scene.
Oh.
And to me, like, the fight scene obviously is hilarious, but that shot where he gets bashed in the back of the head and flies through the window is the funniest thing.
And, like, falls to his death.
Right, he falls, like, 100 feet down the Hollywood Hills.
That is every time I drive past the Hollywood Hills, that's a fear of mine that I'm somehow going to fall off.
Yeah. Now you just picture Roddy Piper diving headlong out of a very expensive pane of glass. And then the last main part, obviously, is Frank, who was played by Keith David, who Carpenter had worked with in The Thing. Apparently, he just wrote the part for him as he was writing. He's like, oh, yeah, Keith David would be good as his character. So he just, and that's it. There was like, good. He didn't, never thought of anybody else. Nobody else is ever in the.
He is perfect.
Yeah, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
Keith David's really great.
He's got so much heart. Because, like, he cares about him, but he's like, you know, after the thing goes down, he's like, look, just stay away from me, and then it leads up to the thing in the alley.
He's
easily the most well-thought-out character in this movie.
Right, yeah.
Well, he might be the best actor, is what it comes down to.
That too.
He absolutely is.
But, he gives a backstory and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of other characters have that in this film.
No, well, I don't think, like, I mean... Piper's character is literally named Nada, so he's supposed to be kind of a blank canvas to an extent. Like, we know where he is, so we kind of... He's like an archetype more than anything, whereas Keith David's character is, like, very clear that, you know, he's got a family, he's just super just trying to keep his head down and keep his job and mind his own business. I mean, he says, like, nobody bothers me, I don't bother anybody, you know, like...
He says it a lot, but he still deeply cares. Like, he went to find him to give him his money.
Yeah,
those are the people that are the biggest problem in this view of the world in this movie.
100%,
You know, it's not just the people who are selling out to the aliens, it's the people... What's the expression, you know, all evil needs to triumph is for good men to remain silent?
Right.
And it's sort of an indictment of centrism, which is super relevant now. And there's a conversation they have where he's like, I'm walking a fine white line right now. And then Piper says, white lines are down the middle of the road. That's most dangerous place to drive. Or, you know.
Yeah.
Like, right.
So
But yeah, there was also, speaking of Roddy Piper's name in this movie, Nada, one of my favorite things in researching this movie is this bit of very circular trivia they gave on the IMDb trivia page. It blew my mind when I read it. So just buckle in. So Roddy Piper's character is given the name Nada, or is given the name Nor. He's referenced throughout the entire movie as Nada, which in Spanish means nothing. The name is most likely a reference to George Nada, the main character of a Ray Nelson short story, 8 o'clock in the movie, which is the basis for this film. They added in so much extra information.
Right.
Yeah.
To that.
Just say. Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
His so. Name is Nada in the movie, which is a reference to this guy. We don't need to know.
Yeah.
The weird. Origin of the word Nada.
I know Spanish.
Yeah.
Look, it's a name of the character in the story that the movie's specifically based on.
Yeah.
That's like saying, like, trivia for Jurassic Park is Sam Neill's character is named Alan Grant, which is likely taken from the character Alan Grant from the novel Jurassic Park.
Exactly. Like, I was really like, hoping...
A grant is something that a government will give an artist to.
Right.
We mentioned the score earlier. It's,
Doom, doom, doom.
Mm.
Just put that on a loop, kids.
And that's the entire film. It's John Carpenter again working with Alan Howarth, who he also worked on.
He needed help. He
yeah,
needed help well, to write that. I figured yeah. He's just sitting there and he's like, man, after Halloween, he's like, I can do anything. Give me a keyboard. Give me a bass. How do you play this thing? What is this? A Sousa Mavuse?
He figured out two notes on bass and he was like, that's good enough.
Nailed it.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the first time he ever, he's like, are we recording? Let's tape the rehearsal just in case we get something.
That's all Alan Howarth did, apparently, was just do what Lyra's doing right now, which is just handle the technical side where he just bangs away on his Casio.
Lyra, a lie is something that someone tells themselves.
So yeah, and it was the same team for Escape from New York. Alan Howarth also worked with him for the score on Escape from New York, which is another...
But I love that song from Escape from New York.
The score is great. It's insane. Also, Alan Howarth looks like Bizarro John Williams. I just wanted to get that out there.
Good note.
Very appropriate. Yeah. Okay, so the movie filmed for 8 weeks in downtown L.A. Carpenter used actual homeless people for the shantytown. He hired a bunch of homeless people and paid them a day's wage and gave them some food to be homeless extras.
That's good for Carpenter for, you know, sticking to the moral of his movie.
Right,
sticking
his
you know who else was a Carpenter? Jesus.
Jesus, that's right. And Harrison Ford. Coincidence?
Mm-hmm.
No.
and Harrison Ford was a pilot, and Jesus can fly.
John Carpenter can fly.
Really?
He can fly a helicopter.
Full circle.
I don't know. I don't know if he flies any of the helicopters in this film, but
which is why Roddy Piper's name in this movie is Nada.
Man, I think like we all just put on our own pair of sunglasses right now.
Yeah. See the world as it is.
That fight scene. We have to talk about.
It's amazing.
Is it still the longest fight scene in movie history?
Probably. It
must be.
5.5 minutes.
It's like, incredible. Yeah.
Carpenter said it was almost an entire reel. Amazing. Just that fight.
I love that.
Which is amazing. Like, he wrote the fight scene after Piper had been cast. He's like, well, we got a wrestler. People are going to want to see him fight.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes the fight. But by writing, I'm doing quotes that another visual element of this podcast you guys can't see. He just wrote, the fight continues, blank page.
Right.
The fight continues, blank page.
Right, that's the Ben-Hur thing of the chariot race starts.
Yeah, or like episode 3, it's just they fight between Vader and Obi-Wan. So he had his stunt coordinator, this guy named Jeff Imada, who also plays all of the aliens in the movie.
Yeah.
Even the lady aliens. Jeff Imada and Roddy Piper and Keith David worked on the fight in Carpenter's backyard for a month and a half.
Just backyard wrestling for a while.
Yeah, basically, yeah. They you know, worked it all out. He told Imada that Carpenter said he wanted an old John Wayne fight. And the fight is kind of modeled after the fight scene in The Quiet Man, apparently, where it's just John Wayne and the other guy fighting through the whole town.
Right, I can see it, because, like, those fights are also very slowly paced.
Very slow, very deliberate.
Right.
Yeah, very realistic. It's like watching like the Sean Connery 007 movies compared to now. It's like Jason Bourne shaking.
Right,
camera,
yeah, where he fights
cut,
with
cut, cut, cut.
Yeah, like where he fights with Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love.
Yeah,
super
I was thinking
different.
Is it the beginning of Goldfinger where he's fighting with the guy in the bathroom and the
guy
ends up in the tub?
Yeah,
it's just positively shocking.
Positively shocking.
But it's just like you don't get face smushing anymore in movies.
No, it's
that's one of the arguments I like to use, too, when people are like, oh, wrestling, it's fake. I'm like, how many cuts are there in one fight in a Jason Bourne movie? Which are the greatest action movies of all time. But wrestling, they're doing it 3 feet from you.
I've always objected to that term because it's like, it's predetermined. I wouldn't call it fake.
Right. It's far more real than TV shows or movies.
Right, like, it's scripted, but they're still incredible athletes doing that.
You ever been slammed on a mat?
Yeah.
In a wrestling
That's
ring?
One of the best. There's like a bunch of reporters are talking to Jesse Ventura. And then, you know, it's politics, it's conspiracies, and then finally it gets to pro wrestling. And if you've ever watched Jesse Ventura talk, when he starts shaking back and forth, he's like getting really fired up for the argument. And the guy's like, well, wrestling is fake. He's like, suppose I pick you up and slam you on the ground. Did you imagine that?
The body.
The body.
It hurts. And they had taken rubber mats and painted them for the alley.
Huh.
But, I mean, they're still...
John Carter, like, what a weird fight choreography design he has for everything.
Yeah.
There are a million other ways to do that. And he picks the weirdest one.
I think they did that in the Exorcist when he goes down the staircase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's, like, thin rubber on each step. But he said, you ever hear this? The,
No.
Who's the young priest in that? I can't think of his name. But anyway, the guy whose character
goes
down the stairs, he's talking to the stunt guy who's about to do it. And he's like, how do you prepare for this? And he goes, I do Zen. He's like, I calm my entire body down and I go numb.
Yeah.
He just, tumbles down.
That's really all you can do because...
It's crazy.
Because you're just diving down a staircase.
Ain't no way to do it except to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
And they don't use stunt doubles in this scene. It's Piper and Keith David all the way.
Right, and Keith David has a boxing background, so...
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, they were talking about
that. Well, they both do.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about Piper until we sat down with you.
I think Keith David clipped him at one point. He definitely cracked
a tooth. They're making contact the whole time. They had worked on it enough where they were hitting.
Well, that's like, yeah, like Piper was trying to... Because it's also you're dealing with a boxer, so it's like... You needed that expertise of like showing him how to like pull the punch without looking like you're pulling the punch. You know, it's fascinating. It's such a fascinating scene.
Yeah,
it's so good. I remember I think it's Mick Foley talking about when he's first starting to wrestle and he was in a match with Terry Funk.
Yes.
And he was like, so how do you fake getting hit in the face and punches?
He's like, I always wondered how he made his punches look so good. He punches you full blast in the face.
Because he just punches the shit out of you.
Yeah, that scene is just so good, and that fight never stops. Every time I'm like, all right,
that's what
finally
done. That's the best part, the pacing of it. It's like, oh, it's over now.
No, it's not. Those are... Mm-hmm.
Then they had to...
You dirty motherfucker.
It's so good.
So good.
They had to... They were talking about it. I think it's Jeff Amata was referencing the story of the fight.
Yeah.
Which, again, is kind of similar to wrestling, where it's like... For a fight to last that long, there has to be some kind of game to it, or else you're just watching two guys pound on each other for an interminable amount of time. And in this, it's try on sunglasses.
Yeah.
Like,
I also love the, you know, as the fight wears on, they keep getting cuts and bruises. At one point, there's just a scrape.
Yeah,
right.
Just meat on the back of Keith
Davidson. It's brutal. The color is perfect.
That fight, the Foley artists on those fights, the people who do the sound effects.
The
Mick Foley artists.
The Mick Foley artists. The sound on those fights, I urge everyone to go back and watch because it is insane.
Yeah.
It sounds like whatever those people were doing, it sounds like they were just dropping like heavy bags of sand on the ground every time they punch each other. It sounds like these guys are hitting each other with cement fists. It's so great. Good. So every punch, you're just like, oh, they're dead now. That's a dead person.
Clearly, this is it, right? I mean, they've both been killed. We've watched two men die.
Right, just from the sound of it alone. Right. It sounds horrifying.
That's so great. Of course, the episode of South Park, Cripple Fight.
Yeah.
Where Jimmy and Timmy fight is just this fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy even says, you dirty motherfucker.
Dirty motherfucker.
The world through the sunglasses is all matte paintings. So every time Piper looks through the sunglasses and sees, you know, the billboards and everything, those are just all matte paintings.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it looks really good.
There's a famous artist who took his the guy who does all the Obey stuff.
Yeah, the Andre the Giant things.
Yeah, I think Shelley
Shepherd Fairey.
Shepherd Fairey. He took the Obey from this movie.
Oh, that's
cool.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, it's from this movie. But the art in this movie is amazing. That graffiti that opens the movie is really cool.
Shepherd Fairey was going to RISD at the time, and he was showing a buddy how to do the now I can't think of what
stencil.
And he's like, here, and he just grabbed a Providence Journal and just cut out the picture of Andre, like they were advertising a show at the Civic Center. I love that.
That's awesome. Oh,
man, and then WWE sued him. That's why he had to change. That's why it only kind of looks like Andre now.
Right.
Oh, man. Yep.
That's a bummer.
Yep. You remember? Do you know Shepherd Fairey's big? How he like how he got like major spotlight on himself for the Andre the Giant thing? Mm-hmm. He climbed up on a billboard that Buddy Cianci was running for re-election of mayor in Providence and put a giant Andre the Giant face over his head, and then it became this huge scandal in the world. It was amazing.
That's perfect. Yeah. Oh, man. So the aliens are masks with silver balls in the eye holes.
What?
Yeah.
Couldn't tell.
They are not real aliens.
Yeah, that's...
But are they dead? Well, they're not. They live.
Yeah. They live, you sleep. It's the graffiti in the church where the title comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The stuff in the alien base are those underground tunnels that you hear about in Los Angeles that connect, like, City Hall and the police station and stuff
like that.
I was just... That's so strange. I didn't even put it together, but I was thinking... Maybe this is why it popped in my brain. I went to Fordham University in the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
and there are underground tunnels underneath Fordham. Because it's also, it's the Jesuit priests are, you know, there's like a lot of conspiracy theories about them. And like, you know, they're the only priests that perform exorcisms, actually.
Oh, wow.
And the technical advisor for the exorcist, Father O'Malley, was, he didn't teach at Fordham. He taught the Fordham prep kids, but like he would do mass and you could talk to him and stuff. He's in the movie. He's the priest that's playing the piano when she comes down the stairs and pees on the carpet. He's the last image in the movie.
Oh, wow.
She kisses him, and then they drive away, and he's standing there. That's...
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
That's
I didn't realize that.
And, well, it wasn't on 9/11, but the mayor's office of emergency management, whatever it was in the World Trade Center. Before that, it was a bunker underneath Fordham University.
Oh, wow.
So we went walking around the main building, McGinley. Oh, no, not McGinley. We were in Keating, which is like the big, iconic main building in Fordham. In the basement, there was like a lot of closets and stuff, and we'd heard a rumor that there was a tunnel that you could get access to, and we found it, and we walked the whole way down, like a couple turns, black, like eventually there's no light anymore, and then it leads all the way around to just a random door in a basement of one of the dorms, like near the laundry room.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
That's so like, creepy.
Apparently there's a
real creepy.
Apparently there's a ton of them like that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, this movie's like steeped in conspiracy theories, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much so that when the movie was released, it was number one in the box office for 1 week, and then it was out of the theaters within 4 weeks, and both.
Wow.
It's weird, right?
That is really weird.
It lost like each week. It lost like 50% of its theaters. Like it was in like something like 2,500, and then it lost 500, then it lost 500 more, and then it was gone. It's very strange. But Carpenter and Keith David maintain that they angered the wrong people with this movie, and it was removed
from
theaters.
That is
people can't see it if it's not playing anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, that's such a disgruntled artist, John Carpenter, who's mad at the 1%. They're like, they just don't get it, man.
Yeah.
So you can hear this on the DVD commentary to the movie, but Roddy Piper, the sweet, sweet man, thought that this movie... and maintained that this movie was an actual incident that happened in the 1950s where TV planted subliminal messages in women's brains, making them buy extravagant items. Piper said he saw that in a documentary, some French documentary, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce, but it was a comedy short that he thought was a documentary.
Oh, God,
he thought this
him.
Movie was real.
Well, there was that whole... like subliminal messages and advertising. And
yes.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Oh, we'll give him that.
We'll give him that. Yeah.
I'll grant you that. He was at Andre the Giant's house, and he's like, "Roddy, come look at this documentary,"
and just went way over his head. And he's also Roddy Piper. Clearly, didn't know what he signed up for because he's a big Reagan guy.
Yeah, he didn't talk about... Really? When they were promoting the film, he didn't talk about the political aspect to it at all because he didn't agree with it. Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, he's making a ton of money. He doesn't want to pay taxes, blah, blah, blah.
He seemed... It's weird when you listen to the commentary, which was obviously recorded many, many years later, he seems to agree with it now.
Right.
You know?
He's come around.
But now that he's not like, you know...
He's awake now.
A wealthy man in the 80s. Yeah, he was woke before he put on his sunglasses.
Woke Waddy Wiper.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But he thought he was just telling a true story.
and when he gets to that part, like, Carpenter does not know what to say. He's like, really? Wow. Okay. And they just kind of keep going.
How does a movie go from number one at the box office to then out of theaters a month later? Is that common?
Yeah.
Not to lose.
Not really.
To have such a steep drop-off.
That is
unusual.
Movies have definitely done it before, but they're all kind of jarring movies.
But I mean, yeah, this wasn't, you know,
this is
the
not
Pest
what...
with John Leguizamo. This was
no.
number one at the box office, and then all of a sudden what the word of mouth was, oh, it sucks, don't go.
Yeah, that might have been for this, because I know it's not, kind of like Escape from New York, which we talked about this aspect of a little bit last week's episode, not really the movie that you might expect it to be. Because this movie is ostensibly...
If it was 88, was this around Christmas? This
it was
after the election.
November 4th, I think, is when it released in 88.
That might have been Election Day.
Yeah, that's true.
So there would have been some, like, Thanksgiving movie.
Yeah. Maybe 88. Ernest Saves Christmas. I don't know when that came out.
I have to imagine this is a weird movie to market, because it's
Well,
a bit of everything.
And if you go to it thinking, oh, it's a sci-fi action movie...
It's not quite
not
that...
not much action in the first 45 minutes.
Yeah, you
minutes.
Hear John Carpenter and you're like, oh, it's a horror movie. It's not quite that
either,
even though it has... That baseline is very creepy, horror-y.
And this is also like, you know, people have been seeing, you know, like Commando and things blowing up, and now it's Roddy Piper, and it's
right.
Yeah,
getting
huge,
beat.
Huge.
Yeah, like, it's something he also specifically wanted, and it's the through line in a lot of Carpenter's movies, is he likes his heroes to be sort of believable and human and mortal and everyman, so it's like...
I also love a movie, any movie, where there's at least one character who just gets the crap beat out of him the whole time.
Yeah.
Like Ash in Evil Dead 2 or Michael Palin in Fish Called Wanda. There's just like...
Right, and they just...
Just getting pummeled
brutalized.
The whole time.
Yeah.
I love that for... I don't know why.
But yeah, I can see... It makes sense to me that word of mouth like affected this movie.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because, yeah, you have a big director like the guy who did Halloween come in, and then you had this movie that's a weird hodgepodge of sci-fi and action and
people
horror.
People are also like, oh, it's Roddy Piper. He's going to be this loudmouth, faster. And it's the 80s, too, where they're like, you want that,
and, yeah,
you
in
know,
the
Morton
beginning,
Downey Jr.
Yeah, and he barely speaks for the first half, and then he spends the second half getting his ass kicked.
Right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So that's how the movie was made. Let's get into some observations in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit. Secret Things.
Actually, that was the working title of this movie. Hidden
Bullshit. Yeah. Some kind of obvious stuff, some symbolism you might not have noticed. The preacher, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but he's a blind oracle, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's blind, but he's the only one who can see.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's receiving.
And then everyone else has to wear glasses that a blind person would wear.
They're sharing. He's kind of like the oracle from Macbeth, because they have to share one eye, which is the sunglasses, to see what he can see. He receives the transmissions directly. So remember, there's that scene where they're watching the pirate transmission, and Piper looks over and sees that the preacher is mouthing the words, even though he can't see or hear the television set.
Yeah. This is separate, but speaking of glasses and blind people, when they give them the contacts, it's so clear Roddy Piper and Keith David both don't know how to put in contacts.
They just kind of like...
They put the container thing just in up to their eyes.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not...
Hopefully, they're just stabbing
themselves in the eye.
Right. I like to imagine, like, if I was the Foley artist, this would have been my first pitch for it. Hopefully you can hear this at home, kids. Just...
Yeah.
Like that's how they put in the sun.
Yeah.
Put in the contacts.
Just jamming them in there.
Right.
Like
so,
they're,
yeah.
Like
someone
they're cramming two Legos together.
Yeah. Someone, I think Keith David, like, puts his eye into the case, assuming it would, like, suction into his eye.
Yeah, it's Keith David.
It's a crazy way to put in contacts.
Piper actually gets it on his hand, but then he just.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. The aliens, they look like dead people.
Right.
Which we keep talking about.
Right. And the title is zombie movie-esque.
Yeah, They Live. I think that's meant to be another form of attack on the elite class because it's like they're rotting.
Right, and they're not human.
Yeah.
And they're not human anymore. They've sort of gotten to the top. They've gone to seed, and they're just like
They're
rotting while everybody else...
They're dead inside and out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Very astute.
Formaldehyde face.
In this subtle film.
In this very subtle, even-handed film.
It's one of the few moments where he really lets loose and just starts cutting a promo on
people. Yeah, yeah. He's like, you're okay, but you're real fucking ugly.
Really fucking ugly.
He's is just cutting a promo.
And not explaining himself at all.
No, yeah, no.
What does he say to her? You look like you were dipped in honey back in the 50s or so. He says something really weird.
He says... awful things to this old lady.
Yeah.
Who's got a Dick Tracy watch.
Yeah.
They all have Dick Tracy
watches. Yeah. One who can see.
That teleport them to space and or the catacombs. Bing. Whichever.
Right, wherever they want to go.
Like the purple pandas on Mr. Rogers. They just go bing and they vanish.
Yeah.
Also, the film's title, you mentioned that really awesome piece of graffiti that opens the film.
Yeah. Mm.
The title fades into the graffiti and becomes hidden. So it's like the theme of the movie. It's like a subliminal message. Tied into this, you know, mural that is a depiction of lower class life, or like, you know, it's a piece of graffiti on the side of a...
Right, it's not high art.
No, it's low art, and it's showing like the urban sprawl. You can see the church in it, and then all the buildings that they go to in the film, so it's like...
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie, it's pretty on the nose.
Oh yeah, there's some subtleties, but I think the graffiti's the most subtle.
Yeah.
And that's pretty explicit.
Well, it's totally subtle. Like, he's actually talking about the real world.
Yeah.
Like, the rich people really are doing this to us.
They control us.
Like,
I get it now.
Yeah. Like, they just want us to consume and be good consumers.
I mean, it's on the nose to a fault where, like, really any conspiracy theory could, like, slide in to what Carpenter's talking about, which is unfortunate and happened with this movie.
I was going to say, Bridget, would you care to speak to that?
Yeah, John Carpenter had to come out after, I think, some resurgence of this movie.
Last year, I think.
Where a bunch of neo-Nazis were like, this is about the Jews!
Oh, God.
And John Carpenter had to come out and publicly be like, no, it's about rich. You don't get it. Like, he's just super exasperated. But yeah, because of this movie's, I want to say, lack of nuance.
You would think it would. Yeah, but you're right. It does leave itself open because it's about.
Yeah, it's such blank slate conspiracy theory is right. If your conspiracy theory was right about whatever class of people you don't like.
Deep state secret ruling class.
Alex Jones could have made this movie.
It's so funny to me because it's like, I'm much more to the left,
right?
You know, than anything,
mm-hmm.
and like that's why this movie speaks to me. That's why like conspiracy theories always kind of spoke to me because it's like, they're the fucking 1% are controlling everything. But then it's like, it is that strange thing where
horseshoe theory of like each side is the same. Ultimately.
Like I remember like during like when they were debating the bailout in 2008. Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders were like appearing together on CNN, like, no, we agree on this. This is bad. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, this thing must be really fucked up if these two are like arm in arm. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It is.
It definitely is.
Because you can look at guys now, especially in the context of like just the world today, like looking at a lot of the work of like Bill Hicks or George Carlin, be like, if you took away everything where they ever made it totally clear that they were on the left, you could be like, oh, are they libertarians?
Right. Oh,
It never even clicked in my head like, oh, John Carpenter's a libertarian until you said it. Yeah. I was always like, oh, this guy's on the left and he's like, you know, fuck the Republicans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here specifically, but he's very just anti-government in general, you know, like snakes, an anarchist libertarian.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting.
This movie...
It has the right idea.
Yeah, because even if you take out the aliens, it's still very staunchly anti-capitalism.
It's anti-capitalism. It's a pretty...
Anti-consumerism, more specifically.
Yeah.
Right, which is like, Jello Biafra. Which is true.
Yeah, his message is pretty poignant.
And still is.
Relevant,
yeah.
It still is, and I think why this movie holds this cult status, because like... yeah, he's really onto something here, but also
it's funny, yeah, the part that he didn't feel the need to be that specific about.
Yeah, it just gets co-opted, and it's such like, a shame.
He's like,
yeah.
Well, this doesn't
well, you
need
don't
to be more
alienate
specific.
People oh, with right. conspiracy.
With your yeah. aliens.
I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a conspiracy video on YouTube that doesn't use clips from this movie.
Yeah. Super is, true, yeah.
It's great.
That is unfortunate and not what John Carpenter meant in this movie, and that's pretty clear to, I think, most people. But if you are a conspiracy theorist, you can just be like, "What? That's what I've been saying this whole time."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to segue to a segment that talks about scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot. We like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
If they had really gone into detail of how the glasses worked.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he goes in that lab, and there are just beakers of liquid.
Yeah, it's just random right. science yeah. stuff, just and like, somehow yeah. sunglasses.
Right, yeah. I was like, what? Purple liquid did they put on mm-hmm. these sunglasses? Yeah.
She didn't blind me with science on this occasion.
And then, like, maybe. The next day they have contacts. It's like, why weren't they producing the contacts? Like, what breakthrough did they have?
They were working on
in 24 hours.
They had to get rid of the frames.
Right.
I want to see the what must have been whirlwind day in between the police raid and then when they find their friend, who is never named in the film, but in the credits he's credited as Drifter. Their homeless friend who has been accepted into the fold of the alien society.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Something huge happened in that day.
Right, his life yeah. changed.
Right, because we see him getting cornered by the cops, and the next time we see him, he's in a tuxedo, he's right. all cleaned up, and he's, like, rich with space bucks. He's toured the galaxy. That was a breakneck 24 hours, and I think we deserve to see part of what happened in that dude's life. What did he say to those cops?
I also...
They're like, hold on, wait, this is yeah. the guy.
Yeah, we need this guy on the team.
Starting lineup, this
yeah.
guy.
He was a stooge.
He was a stooge.
Yeah, he just said yes,
yeah.
I guess.
And then he gets away.
He's like
he
in.
He teleports away, probably somewhere in space. We
yeah,
never see him
I
again.
Mean, he's a real winner of this whole thing. Maybe John Carpenter was like, yeah, just be like that guy.
You're right, yeah.
He's a real winner. I just really wished, and I was expecting this to happen in watching this movie, for Nada and Frank to ask that guy a question.
Just any questions.
Like, just
yeah.
ask.
They're just...
I just wanted someone to ask a question of like, all right, what is it? You say cattle, so they're using us for our resources? What resources? Also, how many of there are there? How many of them are there that they're just teleporting space?
Right,
using
we see them
several different species this way.
Yeah, transferring freely between worlds with,
right.
with this space teleportation thing
yeah.
that Nod and Frank see and just accept.
Yeah,
like, they don't ask a single question.
Why Earth? Why do they want our money?
Because right, it seems like that's all they're taking is our money.
Money, exactly.
They're just like enjoying, like
right.
you see, yeah. like in the end of the movie when they smash the antenna and you see all the aliens, like there's one in a band, like he's just enjoying being in a band.
Right, and then, yeah, I just, like, well, someone.
There's one alien in that commercial where they're all playing like tennis and they like high five.
Right. Right, and.
They're just enjoying yeah. the good life.
No one, yeah, immediately once the world wakes up, everyone just freaks out, which, understandable.
Right.
But no one seems to ask, like, what is going on?
It
and
just
it, is,
makes
it
too
remains
much sense.
Unclear. Yeah.
It's right. like, oh, this is what's been going. Because there is, it's like in The Matrix when he's right. like, you know there's something wrong with the world.
Right.
You don't know what it is. And
yeah.
then finally somebody's like, oh, it's this. Oh!
I mean, that is so far from what I anticipated, but
right.
yes,
right.
it makes total sense.
And the specifics don't quite make sense.
Right.
Again, like, why do they need money if they can just go anywhere
just,
and, like...
They're just chill-ass aliens.
They're super chill. They
yeah,
just want to, like, party
chill.
On yachts, I guess.
And if you're just like, yo, man, I'm cool with it, they'll be like, all right, word, here's your tuxedo.
Right.
Come to our party.
Come to our space dinner.
And they're real myopic, too. They don't notice... Like, the first guy that Piper's looking at the newsstand, he's leering at him
right.
with the sunglasses on. The guy's like, what's your problem? And it's like, clearly he sees that you're a monster. Like, you know you're a monster.
Right.
And if somebody's suddenly, like, looking at you and then keeps lifting these glasses up and down, like, clearly the glasses are the
right.
the X factor here. And then when he and Frank walk into the Biltmore, like, dressed like fucking...
Yeah,
dirty with machine guns. They're,
right,
nobody notices them.
Nobody notices them.
Chillest aliens.
It's hubris.
Yeah. It's true. They're blinded
yeah.
by their hubris.
Mm-hmm.
It's also just great because he puts on the sunglasses and he was like, I knew something was wrong, but immediately just starts shooting people.
Oh, yeah.
Just like immediately.
Not people.
I mean aliens, yeah.
He starts
shooting what he now believes and knows are aliens, but doesn't ask questions like, are these weird sunglasses that a crazy that I found in a crazy church that I was mistrustful of in the first place and immediately just trust what that church was doing after not trusting it?
His allegiances are thin, except his allegiance to humanity, which is unbroken, unwavering.
Yeah. If you was watching TV and then you looked over and then you're like, you see a homeless guy saying all the same stuff,
right?
You're like, I might have to start shooting people.
Yeah,
right. Like, and that segues
glasses
pretty...
or no?
Yeah,
crazy cool weird sunglasses or not?
I just wouldn't know who to aim for. I guess
I think
Roddy's a little. He's got stronger convictions than I do.
He does. Like he knows his purpose now that he sees all the monsters.
Save humanity. And I love the ending of this movie where it's just so nihilistic and he's just giving the finger to the satellite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on the top of not knowing that just shooting it would work.
And it's
perfect for the character to just like, everyone's so nihilistic by the end of the movie and just like, fuck it all. Nothing matters. And it ends up saving the world. That like level of nihilism is so great.
It's such a perfect ending.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it so much. I love that it ends with the lady having sex with the freaky alien.
Oh, my God. Well, because
what's
wrong, baby? Also, stunt coordinator Jeff Amata.
Yeah, because this movie is made in the 80s, so there needs to be one gratuitous pair of boobs in the movie.
Yeah, there needs to be some boobs, yeah.
Right. Unless he was going to wait 2 more years to make this movie when we're out of that phase, but...
It lasted for a while. You used to be able to put boobs in PG-13 movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Those days are over.
16 Candles is PG.
They say
fuck and there's boobs.
Airplane, too. Yeah, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Airplane is PG.
Yeah. Stupid space aliens making all our movies.
Goddamn aliens. We've pretty much, I mean, normally we segue into our final segment, Let's Overthink It, but we've pretty much been talking about that the entire episode with just the themes and stuff. I guess the only thing I would add is that Piper, as the avatar of Carpenter himself, it's clearly just living out a revenge fantasy of the disastrous time he had in the 80s. And just as soon as Piper gets a pair of glasses that tells him who to shoot, he goes straight to the bank and starts killing people.
Exactly. He's very strong-willed.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have that, like, all right.
Was he going to the bank by accident?
No, he walks straight into the bank.
Yeah.
He's, like, trying to get off the street or something, right? And then he realizes he's in a bank?
I'm not sure. It seems purposeful. I don't know.
Yeah. Because
he specifically calls out the banks when he's in the unemployment office in the beginning. It's like 13 banks closed in Denver that I was in there.
I mean, maybe that is also the fact that he doesn't ask questions and is super just like on board to start doing what he feels is right is maybe goes into this movie's indictment of centrism.
Oh, yeah.
That he doesn't waste time being like, well, what are they really doing
here? Well, let's hear
both
sides.
Let's hear, which is what I'd want to do.
Just like, well, no, they're clearly monsters. Secretly in control.
Right. Yeah. I guess in this case, judge a book by its cover.
Right.
It is strange. The thought hasn't occurred to me till just now. Like, he's a mass shooter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He walks into
many guns.
Oh, yeah.
He and Frank walk into the CNN building in downtown Los Angeles and start shooting people.
He also, again, shot up a bank.
He did shoot. The first thing he does is he kills two cops and goes into a bank and shoots people.
Because on the one hand, you could be like, oh, he's here to rob the bank. Okay. But then, like...
He just starts killing, does not ask for money.
Nope.
No, he's not interested in money.
Because money is the evil here.
Money is meaningless.
You could not make this movie.
You see it clutched in the news guy's hand. It says, this is your God on it when he looks at
Right.
Yeah,
that was cool. Yeah.
That was pretty dope. All the stuff you see through the sunglasses is pretty dope. But you super couldn't make this movie today. Not at all.
You can have the sentiment, but it could
maybe
not be executed this way.
Up until that point, maybe the worst thing that happened is like, in the 80s, there was a guy that brought a gun into a McDonald's. That was really it. Like, up until... You know, the 90s and Columbine and stuff, the analogy was always, oh, I'm going to go up to a clock tower with a rifle because the guy in Texas,
in Austin.
Yeah, this was a guy, he was just an ex-Marine who was upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can definitely, the sentiment is very relevant. But yeah, the execution is not.
Good use of the word execution.
Right. Because that guy, the clock tower guy, you could superimpose the plot of this movie.
By this time, that was like a cliche and a joke. Like that's one of his like visions in Parenthood, that he screwed up his son and now he's up in a clock bell tower shooting people.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
It's like was the, you know, mailmen go crazy type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie hits a little close to home now. Especially like between police brutality.
All the extreme police violence, the wealth.
Right. The over and under of the world has gotten worse since They Live came out.
Right, yeah.
It's
we did not listen to John.
No, yes, this movie is poignant now.
Yeah. It really is.
Man. Mm-hmm. Poignant. Mm. Very good word.
Yeah.
Yeah, anybody have any final thoughts about the movie?
I like it.
Oh, it's great.
It's really a delight to watch. It takes a while to warm up to it.
If you're going to be this guy for Halloween, you got to get the perfect plaid.
Perfect flannel, you know? Perfect thermal undershirt.
Yeah.
He looks like a perfect badass of like those acid wash jeans, the flannel shirt, and just the gun strap behind him and the sunglasses on indoors, and you're like, he's coming to fuck shit up.
Man, my mind was blown when, like, because Roddy, like, he grew his hair long.
Right.
And all of a sudden you're just like, wow, he looks even crazier with long hair.
That was one that, there's that scene in the motel room where he's, like, washing up after the fight, and he has a shirt off, and you're like, right, he's a wrestler. He's not a normal human. Because see how jacked he is. And I was like, that's not a normal guy.
You always have in the construction scene in the beginning, too, when he's working, you're like, right. Because, like, in wrestling, Piper's not a huge guy. Like, Hogan and everybody.
Yeah.
Like, Piper's like, he seems like a midweight kind of guy. But when he's around normal people, you're like, oh, he's huge.
Yeah, that's like, a massive man.
That's the thing. It's like, I was talking about this with somebody about, like, some wrestlers, and I was like, I was making the point of, like, you know, like, you don't even consider how enormous they are. Like, guys that you don't even, because, you know, you're stacked up against, you know, Hogan and Andre and stuff, and then, you know, Austin or The Rock, they're just huge. But then it's like, even a guy like the Road Dogg Jesse James, like, if you met him, he's a guy that would come off like, oh, he's smaller than the rest of them, and he may be or may not, but he's huge.
Any pro athlete, like
oh my god, enormous.
Right, yeah, because like point guards in the NBA run into in real life, and you're like, oh, you're the short one. You're still 6'7".
Right.
It's super apparent anytime Roddy Piper is like around other people working on the construction site or like cleaning up. You're just like, this man's massive.
Oh, you're just a psychotic mountain. Okay. Yeah.
You are terrifying if you walked into a bank with a gun.
Yeah.
Oh, also around this time, he made a pilot that didn't get picked up with Jesse Ventura. They aired it.
We were deprived of that?
Oh, man.
Called Tag Team, where they were wrestlers who got blacklisted, and then they became private investigators.
What?
Yeah.
We were...
This is on YouTube for sure.
Robbed of a show where Roddy Piper and Jesse the Body Ventura solved crimes.
Yep. And at the end of the... All I remember about the pilot is at the very end... Like a dog is involved somehow and helps them. And then at the very end, they're like, they have the dog and they're like, I know what to name. And I know what to name him. They say it at the same time, Body Slam. And, then, and it ends like that.
Incredible.
It feels like they might.
How did this not get picked up?
I'm probably imposing this on, but I feel like they high five with the dog and that's how it ends, you know?
Just a fake paw comes up.
Tag team pop in there. Oh, how perfect. Shit.
That's so good.
We'll do a special episode just on tag team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh. Oh, I'm there.
Okay, so we're done here.
Talked about a lot of other movies, but Live is great.
They Live is an amazing film. Man, I could talk about this movie for another hour at least.
Oh, yeah.
I could do three episodes just
on
this.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
There's so much to get into.
Yeah, that movie ends every time. And I'm like, I have a dissertation on this.
But we want to talk to you about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts. We want to listen. We want to hear them. We want to hear what suggestions you have for directors for us to cover in the future. We've been Tom, Bridget, and Matt. Matt, where can we find you online?
At McCarthy Redhead on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. And listen to the We Watch Wrestling podcast on headgum.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been honored to have you here.
It was a pleasure.
All right, man. And please come back next week. We're going to be talking about The Thing, and you guys have to check back in to make sure I do, in fact, say, here's The Thing.
Mm-hmm. And let me know when you do No Holds Barred, because I'll be here with bells on.
No Holds Barred!
Dookie!
All right. We're done here.
We did it.
We did it.
We did it. Hey guys, Stitcher Premium is entering the musical podcast space with the new three-part series Stolen Idea, written by Matt Besser and Bobby Matthews. Stolen Idea is a comedy punk rock musical that covers the theft of intellectual property in the artistic worlds of music and comedy. The story follows a stand-up comedian and a rock musician who are both approaching 40 and are fearful their time to make it is running out. One has his idea stolen, the other steals an idea. Produced and mixed by Earwolf's lead sound engineer Brett Morris, the 17-song soundtrack features performances by Scott Aukerman, Paul Rust, James Adomian, John Gemberling, Virginia Matthews, Harris Whittles, Mike Cassidy, Mike Still, and Danielle Schneider. Listen to Stolen Idea on Stitcher Premium, and get 1 month of Stitcher Premium free when you go to stitcherpremium.com/stolen and enter the promo code MOVIE. That's stitcherpremium.com/stolen, offer code MOVIE.
Earwolf? More like Fear Wolf. Get ready to quake in your headphones, because Earwolf's movie podcast are talking about horror movies the entire month of October. Listen to How Did This Get Made, The Canon, and Cracked Movie Club dissect spine-tingling horror classics all month long! And watch out for special spooktacular episodes of Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast, The Cracked Podcast. And who charted, or should I say, boo charted? Subscribe to all these shows and follow along on social media with the hashtag FearWolf. And beware of podcasts that go bump in the night!
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.